It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll hear from a nurse who says comics can actually improve the way we talk about health. First, according to President Donald Trump, attorney-client privilege is dead. That's what he tweeted early this morning following the FBI's raid of the office and residence of his personal attorney, Michael Cohen. According to the New York Times, agents took records pertaining to the $130,000 payment that a lawyer made to ex-porn star Stormy Daniels, tax returns, and other financial records. The Washington Post reports that Cohen is being investigated for possible bank fraud, wire fraud, and campaign finance violations. The raids come after federal prosecutors in New York obtained a search warrant following a referral from special counsel Robert Mueller. According to the Times, the search doesn't appear directly related to Mueller's Russia investigation, but most likely from information he uncovered during the probe. Cohen's attorney called the raid inappropriate and unnecessary, saying Cohen has been nothing but cooperative with all government entities. And President Trump responded to the raid before a White House dinner last night.
I have this witch hunt constantly going on for over 12 months now, and actually much more than that. You could say it was right after I won the nomination it started. And it's a disgrace. It's frankly a real disgrace. It's an attack on our country in a true sense. It's an attack on what we all stand for.
Harry Littman is a lecturer for the University of California San Diego Department of Political Science and a practicing attorney in California. He's a former U.S. attorney and deputy assistant attorney general. Harry, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with this idea of attorney-client privilege and why it tends to be more rare, it sounds like, for privileged information, attorney-client privileged information, to be raided in this way.
It is rare, and that's the reason I think that what I'm saying is exactly wrong. The Department of Justice has all kinds of special rules that reflect the important value of the attorney-client privilege, and in order to exercise or serve a search warrant, as they did yesterday in an attorney's office, you have to jump through all kinds of hoops. And then once you've gotten the information that possibly could be privileged, you go through all kinds of additional hoops to make sure that only non-privileged material ever goes to the people who are actually working the case.
It's rare to do something like this, but it doesn't mean it never happens. What are the situations where we might see that privileged information lose that privilege?
So there are two, really. First, by the way, I should have said, you can only serve this kind of warrant if you're going after the lawyer. You can't use it as an end around to get to the client. That means that the department showed a magistrate, a judge, that in fact there was probable cause to think Cohen was involved in criminal activity. So one of all the evidence they've harvested, they'll be able to use anything that isn't privileged. And then there is also the provision to use evidence that shows crime fraud. If there's evidence that they've actually committed a fraud, that vitiates or that overcomes the attorney-client privilege, and then you can use the materials. But all of that is going to be carefully fly-specked by a whole different team and probably by a special master for the court itself. The Department of Justice is extraordinarily careful about this, in part because if somebody happens to glance at privileged material, it's like kryptonite. You're very likely to be disqualified from the whole action. It's a big dust-up. It's a mess. So they're very, very careful.
Can you talk about who along the chain of command was involved in approving this decision?
Yeah, I think it's pretty straightforward based on the regulations. Mueller obviously came across the information. It seems pretty clear that the information we're talking about, the bank fraud, the wire fraud, and the election violations all concern the $130,000 payment to Stormy Daniels. He then sits down, goes to the Deputy Attorney General, his supervisor, and says, look, here's this material that's not directly related to my probe. That's the sort of thing, Rob, that, you know, it's as Ken Starr did 10 years ago or whatever. He said, I've got this Monica Lewinsky stuff, and he went to Janet Reno. She said, go ahead, run with it. Rod Rosenstein did the opposite. He said, "Okay, thanks," and he referred it to a different U.S. attorney's office, the Southern District of New York, where Dennis Sweeney and others work, and had them take the ball and run with it going forward. So now it's completely outside of Mueller's probe.
Some people have questioned whether this was done by Robert Mueller wanting a different agency involved to kind of spread out the prosecution and maybe spread out the risk of him being targeted by the president. It doesn't sound like that's what you see happening here.
Yeah, I don't see it, although it sort of has that effect, because if Trump tries or is able to lower the boom and fire Mueller, this particular investigation of Cohen will survive. It's in a separate office. It's a separate matter. It's not under Mueller. So Cohen's in for the long ride no matter what. It is true that it's now that it's got nothing to do with Mueller anymore, but I think that doesn't have to do with any kind of special secret motivation of Mueller. That's just playing by the rules. He comes across, which he always does, by the way. So he just comes across material that's not directly related to his probe. He serves it up to the deputy attorney general to make the decision. It's a pretty smart decision. I mean, they're going to handle it very well in the Southern District of New York, and there's no chance that Trump can get at it, even if he were to successfully fire Mueller.
Talking to Harry Litman, former U.S. attorney, former deputy assistant attorney general, about yesterday's raid on Michael Cohen, personal attorney for President Trump, his home, his office, his temporary apartment, too. It sounds like, Harry, how much trouble could Michael Cohen personally be in here after these raids?
Huge. He's really, really, really in the soup. I think part of it will be to exert pressure on him because of everything he knows about Trump. He's not just his fixer. Sometimes people call him, you know, Tom Hagen after the Robert Duvall figure in The Godfather or the sixth Trump child. He really has the keys to the kingdom. And wire fraud, bank fraud, and election laws, you know, could add up to quite a bit of legal trouble. He's also in trouble ethically. He may lose his license because of the hijinks of this hush agreement with Stormy Daniels that Trump never knew anything about, even though Cohen told Daniels she did. He's already been sued for defamation. You know, he's proudly boasted he'll do anything for Trump and always be loyal. Well, that's certainly going to be put to the test because he's looking at tremendous pressure against him.
If it's true that this raid was only related to the payoffs to Stormy Daniels and another accuser or another person who says she had a consensual affair with the president, could prosecutors come across other non-related stuff that might feed back into other parts, say, of the Mueller-Russia probe?
Definitely. If they're there legitimately and they find evidence, they can use it. And, you know, he was involved in Trump's efforts in 2015 and 16 to build a Trump Tower in Moscow, which seems to have started the whole kind of unsavory alliance between Trump and certain figures. There was an email from Felix Sater that said, you know, we can get our boy elected if we build this tower. That email went to Michael Cohen. You know, his fingers are everywhere. He's Mr. Fix-It. And the general legal rule is if the FBI has a right to sort of be there, to be looking at stuff, and they come across unrelated evidence of a different crime, sure, they can use it. Just the same thing as if they, you know, found it on the street.
I want to wrap up talking about the possible firing of the special counsel, Robert Mueller. President Trump this morning kind of left that open-ended when asked about it. His spokesperson, Sarah Sanders, said that the president believes he has the power to fire Robert Mueller. Under some scenarios, that would also involve firing Rod Rosenstein. What are you thinking about as you look at this possibility of Mueller being fired?
Well, you know, it would be the total crisis to end all crises. Does he have the power? And the short answer is no, in the sense that the regulation that under which Mueller was appointed provides for how he can be removed, and it doesn't give the president a role. But if he's bound and determined to get rid of him and all political consequences be damned, and possibly, you know, engender, they actually get the Republicans in Congress to oppose him, you know, there are different ways. I think what you say, Rob, is the easiest, is to try to go at Rosenstein, or even more cleanly would be to fire Sessions and put in someone there who is not recused. Of course, that person will face quite a confirmation battle. But there are ways, I think, to try to attack him, though they themselves could be obstruction. The problem is, at the end of the day, it's all up to the Republican Congress to say what's impeachable and what isn't. And while there'd be huge political fallout, would it be enough to actually remove him from office? That's the bet he would be undertaking.
Harry, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Harry Lipman is a lecturer at the UC San Diego Department of Political Science and a former U.S. attorney and deputy assistant attorney general. We talked to him about the legal issues surrounding yesterday's FBI raid of President Trump's personal attorney. First, when it comes to talking about our health, including illness, disability, even the prospect of death, things aren't always easy, even for people who make a living in the health professions. What if there was a better way? Our next guest has turned to comics to improve communication about health. She says comics have the power to make health education more engaging and can amplify the voices of patients and families, as well as giving us a good way to explore our experiences with health and medicine. M.K. Serwick is known as the comic nurse. In addition to being a nurse, she's an artist in residence at the Northwestern Feinberg School of Medicine and is one of the founders of the field of graphic medicine. She's giving a talk on the UW-Madison campus tomorrow at 1 p.m. called Building a Culture of Wellness: Can Comics Improve Our Health? M.K., thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, what got you into tackling this question of can I use comics and graphic novels to improve people's health?
Well, it started very personally in that I was working as a nurse on an AIDS unit during the mid-90s before we had new medications to keep the virus under control. And I was really struggling to bridge the world on our unit, which was really just a difficult place, and everything seemed like the worst news and the outcome was always bad, and life off the unit, which was much more balanced, and it just was, I was having trouble bridging that. And so one day I just sat down and drew a little picture and put a few words, put a box around it, made another box, and I stumbled into making comics. And 9 panels later, I found myself in a place of hope and perspective, and I felt ready to go on and take on the next day's challenges at work.
Had you been an artist before that?
No, not at all. I was
really
I was one of those kids at school that the teacher said, put those crayons away, please stop drawing, you can use your words now.
And so when did you start showing your work sharing it with other people?
I think I felt like, so my first degree before I went into nursing was in literature and philosophy, and I'd always wanted a place in the arts, but I never felt like I could find a home. And after I'd made a few comics and realized how powerful this medium was, I felt like I was actually kind of good at it, and that I wanted to share them, and that I felt like it had a lot of potential.
We hear a lot about communication in healthcare between physicians and nurses, for example, healthcare providers and patients and families, so on. And that's a problem a lot of the time. Are you helping to bridge the gap with the comics?
I really hope so and think so. One of the really interesting conventions that comics bring that I've found in my teaching is the power of the speech bubble and the thought bubble. So if you think about, if you're drawing a comic, no matter who you are, whether you're a provider or a patient or a family member, and you're drawing a clinical encounter, you have the opportunity to show what the person is saying and what they're thinking, which really shows what they're worried about, what they're not saying, right? And that's, you know, for the physicians or the nurses, just as well as the patients.
It reminds me of a comic I saw on your website, a daughter and a father out for dinner, and they hear bad news about somebody they know, and they're both thinking about talking about end-of-life care, and they're only doing it through most of it in thought bubble form. Talk about how you set that up and how you frame that for people.
Well, what the goal of that comic was to really just sort of demonstrate that it's a really hard conversation, right, to have, to acknowledge that the person that you love most in the world is going to die and talk about what their hopes and dreams are for what that's going to be like, right? We don't like to talk about that. Mm-hmm. And so I made that comic as a way to sort of model another way of approaching it. And that's part of a larger project, hoping that comics can have a role in approaching those conversations.
We're talking to M.K. Serwick, also known as the comic nurse. She's a nurse and she's also a comic artist. And she says there's a lot of room in comics to help our healthcare communication, maybe ultimately our health. So, M.K., how do you bring this to healthcare providers?
By things like the lecture I'm doing tomorrow and traveling around talking about it, but also through teaching. I teach a course at Northwestern Medical School with first and second year medical students, and I get them to draw about the process of becoming a doctor and the relationships they're learning how to have with their patients.
Is there ever pushback? Like, hey, wait a minute, I'm here to learn anatomy and patient care and things like that, and you want me to draw?
You know, you'd be surprised how much there isn't. Well, first of all, they get to...
It's got to be a nice break, right?
Exactly. I mean, and I start with crayons, and so, like, who doesn't love picking up a box of 24 brand-new Crayola crayons? Quite honestly, they are facing learning so much that they're actually, I think, in a lot of ways, grateful for the opportunity to really start to process it.
You wrote a comic about a pivotal moment in your career, actually. It was your master's thesis, I think, and you're trying to decide, do I do the comic art? Are people going to take me seriously? Am I going to get away with that? Or should I do something a little more traditional? Talk about that key moment.
It was right when I had discovered a book called Mom's Cancer by Brian Feese, and I was finishing a master's in medical humanities and bioethics. And all of a sudden, I was sort of keeping it quiet that I was a cartoonist. I wanted to forefront the comics because this book was so good, and it really gave me hope that comics could have a serious place in the discourse of health and medicine. And yet, I was still nervous about it. I wanted to be taken seriously. And so I just put it to my professor and said, you choose. And what she said was, the other option was oral history. Sure, you could do your master's on oral history and its role in medicine, but we know what the answer is. With comics, maybe the answer is no. Maybe this is a crazy idea. Better to find out now.
You might fail.
Yeah, you might fail. And isn't that a more interesting question when you don't already know the answer?
How do you take this to, or do you take this to patients? Do you bring your work to patients as a nurse yourself?
Not right now myself as a nurse, but I know there's a lot of projects going on around the country and actually around the world. This has kind of become an international movement that we call graphic medicine. And there's research being done about the best way to, you know, medicine is evidence-based, so we want to make sure that we're doing the best practices and establishing those best practices. So there's research about what books are good with what patient population, when in their disease, when with their families. So these things are kind of being studied and looked at all over.
Is the idea that maybe someday, instead of, you know, a pamphlet, how to talk to your family about end-of-life care, or here's some information about dealing with, say, this particular type of cancer, can be a little dense for some people, maybe more than others. Maybe a graphic alternative might be a better one.
Absolutely. And there are quite a few projects that are under research now. Comics are a really incredibly good educational resource when there's a lot of information. It's really important that the person learn the information and they're under a lot of stress. Comics are terrific in a place like that. So think about getting a diagnosis or even being in medical school or nursing school. Those are situations where, yeah, it helps a lot to have a easily accessible medium.
You mentioned one of the graphic novels that was your inspiration. Are there a lot of health-centered graphic novels and comics out there, either by patients or, in that case, a family member or other healthcare providers?
There are hundreds and more being made every
day.
Yes, and they're nonfiction, almost all exclusively nonfiction, and that means they're created by the people who are living through illness and caregiving. And who better to represent that experience? Not the caregivers, but the people who are living through it. They can teach us, and that's why it's great for these books to be read in health education schools.
You mentioned teaching doctors to do this. I assume the idea isn't that each of these doctors is going to go on and create their own healthcare graphic novel, but is there something therapeutic or educational for them to take what they're learning and put it on the page?
It's a terrific way to process information, and that's how we learn. We actually have to have a physical interaction with it, and so this is a terrific structure for doing that.
Could the same thing be done for patients? Again, they're not producing something for anybody else to see?
Right, absolutely. And many people have made the books they've made or even kept journals and said it was a really helpful way to go through things.
Have you heard from patients yourself that you've worked with who have, once you let it out there that you were a comic nurse, did they take that inspiration and do something like that?
Absolutely. I remember I gave one lecture where a nurse in the back of the room, of course, you know, we're all patients and providers, a nurse in the back of the room said, I was just diagnosed with cancer and my family's really worried about me, and I'm going to make them a comic to tell them that I'm okay.
In your work, sometimes they're funny. Sometimes they're very emotionally painful, almost, and that's true, I guess, across the comics world. Can you talk about capturing that range of experience?
Yeah, you know, comics do have an association with being funny, but that's certainly absolutely not the case exclusively. They have the gift of humor to bring, but often, you know, the tools of comics that the comics come with, being able to do so much in facial expressions with just a simple line, allows us to convey that emotion in ways that it would take 1,000 words to sometimes capture that complexity.
Healthcare is a demanding profession, emotionally draining, we hear a lot, and you were working, as you said, in the 90s with HIV-positive patients. Has this been therapeutic for you along the way?
It's definitely been helpful. One of the reasons I created my book, Taking Turns, which is a graphic memoir about that time, was to kind of take a look at that and process that and find a way to kind of be able to walk away from it.
What's it like sharing what was in your thought bubbles in real life, and all of a sudden they're on paper for everybody to see?
Yeah, it's a vulnerable process, but I think it's not unlike any creative endeavor where you really are going to be honest.
So what do you want people, healthcare providers that you're talking to in Madison to know about graphic medicine?
That the books that are out there that I'm going to talk about many different diseases and conditions are really, really useful tools. I would recommend going to graphicmedicine.org, our website, and it has a search panel, and you can kind of see if there's anything out there about any clinical interest area you might have.
MK, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you very much.
That's MK Serwick, also known as the Comic Nurse. She'll be giving a talk on the UW-Madison campus tomorrow at 1 p.m. called Building a Culture of Wellness. Can comics improve our health? You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Do you want to be happier? Try being more like Denmark. It's been ranked among the three happiest countries in the world for 7 straight years. In the 2018 World Happiness Report, the Danes were number 3 behind Finland and Norway. It topped the list in 2013 and 2016. As for the U.S., we were 18th in this year's report, down from 14 in 2017. So what's Denmark doing right? Some people point to a stable government, low levels of public corruption, and access to high-quality education and healthcare. Our next guest says those factors aren't the whole story. She says it's all about the hygg. That's spelled H-Y-G-G-E, and she says if we can adopt that in our lives, we just might become happier people. What's hygg? Well, it's tricky. The Visit Denmark website says it means enjoying the good things in life with good people. Marie Helwig Larsen is a psychology professor at Dickinson College in Pennsylvania. She wrote a piece for The Conversation called Why Denmark Dominates the World Happiness Report Rankings Year After Year. She's also a native of Denmark. Marie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first, am I saying hygge right?
Kind of. It's hygge.
Hygge. Okay, a
yes.
Little at the end of it. Okay, and
yes.
Now that's the easy part. What does it mean? And I understand it's been kind of hard to convey this idea from Denmark to us here in the United States.
So it's a cultural construct, and cultural constructs are complicated because they all interwoven into the culture in many, many different situations, which is why just using a single word or definition, which you're all waiting for, is not fully capturing it. So it's often translated to mean cozy. And that doesn't really get at how it's actually used either by the Danes or how it actually works. So my definition is intentional intimacy, which really gets at how you interact with other people. So in this concept has gotten a lot of attention in international media, and sometimes people think that it has to do with buying things like wool socks or sitting in front of fireplaces, and those can be hyggelig, but that's not really the idea.
So how do we intentionally do something hyggelig?
But very good.
Thank you.
So what we do is that we first have to have intentionality. So you have to actually think about social interactions as needing to create a special space or into action with other people. So it's not involving necessarily, like I said, special equipment like fireplaces or wool socks or cups of coffee, although it can, but more about meeting other people and interacting with them in that space. So it could be something simple like a picnic in the park with your kids in which you're all together and doing something fun. You are creating, having good food, being together in an undistracted way. Or it could be dinner with friends, with dim lighting, good music, good food, and so on.
Is it partly about not just the activity or the people you're with, but the mindset that you come into it with?
That's exactly correct. So it's a compliment to say that an event was hygge. In fact, it would be a pretty harsh social criticism to say that something was not hyggeligt. So it's definitely the expectation that things or events are hyggelig, but things can also be hyggelig. So if you had a new house and you showed your friends around in your new house, they might say, oh, that you know, you made this space so hyggeligt. In other words, you have deliberately created with your furniture or with your lighting or your carpets a space that would invite these kinds of intentionally intimate situations.
Talking to Marie Helwig Larsen, psychology professor at Dickinson College, talking about why Denmark is one of the happiest countries in the world. It's all about the hygge, this concept that we're talking about here. Marie, let's talk about happiness here and how we measure it. Denmark keeps rating high in the happiness rankings. What does that mean?
So psychologists have actually measured what psychologists call subjective well-being for more than 40 years. So there's been many, many, many surveys over the years. And the questions that people ask are what you would think that they would ask, namely, on a scale from 1 to 5, how satisfied are you with your life, or how happy are you with your life, or how do you rank yourself in terms of life satisfaction? And, of course, researchers like to argue about how to measure things, but extensive research shows that you can, in fact, ask people these questions and it provides reliable answers that are interpretable.
And then connect the dots. Why is hygge the reason that Denmark is a player on these rankings?
Well, so that's a little bit of a tougher call because from a research perspective, it's difficult to determine whether something that happens to nearly everyone in Denmark, but nowhere else in the world, could explain Danish happiness, because we are missing some people outside of Denmark who don't go, wait, what? When you ask them what hygge is or whether they enjoy that, and it required Danes to not engage with this concept, which they do. So it's hard to make a causal statement, as I would say, to create these. However, it is connected to a concept that consistently predicts happiness in the happiness ratings, which is trust. So creating spaces in which you are together with other people can certainly help create trust, which in turn is well documented to be related to happiness.
Is there a reason why Denmark would be better at hygge or something like it than we in the United States would be?
That's an excellent question. I think lots of Americans, I've lived here for more than 30 years, do exactly some version of this. They don't call it that, but I think that in my own experience that Americans, in fact, do try to create spaces in which people are asked to put away their devices or the kids are expected to stay at the dinner table for more than the time it takes them to eat and so on. So I think that there are lots of elements in American culture that incorporates these ideas, but perhaps not with the same degree of intentionality.
If somebody's out there listening saying, this sounds pretty good to me, I do feel like I'm not connecting with people in these situations the way maybe I used to or that I would like to, give us some hygge 101. How would we get started doing something like this?
First, put away your devices. I think that's good advice for everyone. It's difficult to be distracted and be intentionally with other people at the same time. Then think about the role of a space that can create a more intimacy. You know, maybe turn down the overhead lights. It might be a good idea to light some candles. Maybe music can help, but music that would enhance the conversational intimacy rather than distract from it. Think about the role of food. Good food can help create intimacy around conversations. think about the space other than the lighting. Are people seated in the right place? Can you actually hear what you are saying? Are you facing each other? So all this kind of intentionality around creating these kinds of interactions.
And I want to talk about other possible factors in happiness or lack of same, because people might think happiness involves economic well-being, access, as we mentioned in the intro, to healthcare, having people like you around you. Talk about some of the different things that do or don't affect national happiness.
So what's so fascinating, in my opinion, about this research is that it's actually the same variables that predict happiness in different countries. So it's easy to think about Denmark, it's small, has a different history, it's perhaps less diverse, and then say, well, but that doesn't mean anything for us Americans who have a different history and have a different culture. But to that, I would say, but it's actually the same factors that predict happiness in the two countries. So corruption is related across nations to low levels of happiness. So high corruption is associated with low levels of happiness. Another factor is trust. So if you have high trust, either in fellow other people, in a personal trust, or in the government or in the media, that's actually correlated very highly with happiness. And the decline in trust in the U.S. is actually associated with its decline over time with happiness. And so is inequality in income. So what seems particularly important, although income is important, both Denmark and the United States are very affluent countries. So affluence is important, but what's much more important is inequality in income, which is, of course, as you can imagine, related to a lack of trust and a basic not believing that the world is fair.
We're talking with Marie Helwig Larsen about the Danish idea known as hygge, which the Visit Denmark website says means enjoying the good things in life with good people. It's a little more complicated than that, she says, but she says it's the key to, or a key to, happiness, with Denmark ranking in the happiest nations in the world year after year. She's a professor of psychology at Dickinson College in Pennsylvania, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you encountered this idea before? What do you think about what you're hearing about hygge? H-Y-G-G-E. Do you practice it in your own life on purpose with that name, or does it sound like stuff you do? Do you set up intentionally these get-togethers with people, maybe your family members, maybe friends, neighbors, whatever, and try to have this non-distracted social situation in your life? Is this kind of connection with people key to your happiness, key to our happiness as Americans? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or are we too unhoogly? We'll find out if that's actually a word coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about the Danish way of life known as hygge. After another top three finish by Denmark in the World Happiness Report, our guest, Marie Helwig Larsen, says we'd all be a little better off, maybe happier, if we practiced hygge. We're talking about what that means. She's a professor of psychology at Dickinson College in Pennsylvania. She's from Denmark herself. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you feel connected enough with the people in your life, friends, family, neighborhood, neighbors, people in your community? Do you have gatherings that you think match what she's saying about hygge, where people are together? There's a intimacy. People aren't distracted. They're talking. They're getting along. They're maybe playing board games, picnics. Do you do this kind of stuff? Do you have these gatherings? Did you used to and wish you could get back to it? Call 800-642-1234. If you have been to Denmark yourself or are from there, love to hear from you on all this as well. 800-642-1234 is the number, or text us, or email us, I should say, ideas@wpr.org. To your calls at 800-642-1234. Gary is with us in Brookfield. Gary, hi.
One of the things, I grew up in Racine, and one of the things that I think makes the Danish people so happy is Kringle.
The Kringle. Okay. Racine, a big place for Kringle. Gary, thanks for that call. And Marie, all right, maybe a little jokey there, but Kringle is the kind of food that you're not going to eat and talk on your cell phone at the same time. It's sticky. You've got nothing to do with your hands but eat the Kringle, and that maybe you can interact with people while sharing this treat.
I agree. I think the crinkle is amazing. All Danish pastry. I would highly recommend it.
Thanks, Gary, for that call at 800-642-1234. Michelle, our technical director, mentioned her fondue pot as creating an environment like this. And I think of, you know, it could be a fireplace or a campfire or just something that people sit around that you'd feel like kind of a jerk if you picked up your phone in the middle of it. Is there something to that centerpiece, that thing that you're around that can be important to this, Marie?
Definitely. And I also think on the issue of not being distracted that we often blame young people or kids for being on devices all the time. But I think that adults are just as distracted and unwilling to, you know, put away being connected with other people when they actually should be connected to the people who are in the room with them.
You've been in the United States a long time, Marie, but do you intentionally try to bring the Americans around you into this concept of hygge, and how does it go over?
I do try that, and it often goes over extremely well. There's always, even though I've been here for many years, situations in which you are expecting a different level of interest and commitment. For example, New Year's Eve is a very important social event in Denmark, and we're not so used to people leaving the New Year's Eve party at 10 o'clock because they think it's late. So that would have been an example of a party that was not having necessarily the desired degree of hygge because people are leaving before it seems that they should, which should at least be after midnight.
I'll confess to being guilty sometimes of going to an event or a gathering just to sort of be polite and put in an appearance. And I think I've done that at a New Year's Eve gathering or two. That is pretty unhygge, if that's a word.
That is exactly a word. And in fact, uhygge in Danish means scary, which is an interesting contrast.
Let's bring on another caller now. Donna is with us in Brookfield. Donna, hi.
Hi. Well, I want to say that I think I've been doing hygge for the past couple of years without even knowing it. About 4 years ago, I asked my husband, I said, why don't people have dinner parties anymore? And he goes, I don't know. And I said, let's invite some other couples over. So for the past 4 years, a couple of times a year, we invite like three or four other couples over. We have wine and we have dinner and we have music and we just talk and we laugh and we can go for hours like that. And it's an awesome time. And I'm like, why did dinner parties fall out of fashion? I love them.
And Donna, when you invite people, is there a moment of weirdness? Like, that's not something we really do anymore, before they say, yeah, and then have fun with it.
No, they all love the idea. And they said, wow, that's really a great idea. And they're all anxious to come over.
Donna, thank you so much for sharing that with us today. And this is me, definitely, Marie, as the person who doesn't really do this much. And you watch old TV shows, and it's like, seems like people are having dinner parties all the time. Is that something we need to go back to?
I think Donna gets an A+ on hygge, definitely.
Is there something about like doing a dinner party right, though? It seems like it could still be awkward and lack that intimacy that should be involved in hygge.
So maybe your friends need to be hygge trained. That would be a possibility. So they need to be trained to show up and be ready to engage in this kind of intentional way. And you can, of course, set the, you know, you can model this by having created a space and an event that suits this.
Donna,
such as, for example, sitting around the dining room table.
Donna, thanks so much for the call. I'll watch for my invitation. We'll go next to Mike in Milwaukee. Mike, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What'd you want to tell us about?
Well, I married into a large Danish family from Chicago about 10 years ago, and at first I thought it was a lot, the different events that they had, and after a while I came to understand just how important the family is for them. They often, whenever anybody comes over from Denmark, they always get together. They have several get-togethers to celebrate people coming over to visit. And they have the Danish house in Chicago, and they all raise funds to help provide a great home for their elderly that is surrounded by all the culture and the food and the music. And it's just terrific.
Mike, thanks a lot for sharing that story with us. Marie, how important is a family as a part of this story of hygge?
I think it's important, but I think family is important to people around the world. So I'm not sure that just being connected with family is uniquely Danish. I think that is true for all of us, or even having friends. I think it more has to do with how you interact rather than your desire to be with friends and family, which I think we all share.
Thanks for that call, Mike. We're talking to Marie Helwig-Larsen, professor of psychology at Dickinson College, talking about happiness and the Danish concept of hygge. A little hard to pin down, but I think we've gotten a good start on it. Jesse joins us next in Oshkosh. Jesse, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
What do you want to bring up, Jesse?
Well, this struck a chord with me in a good way. When I was growing up, my cousins and I would weekly meet at my grandma's house and play and have fun and uninterrupted pleasure. As we grew into adulthood, there were fewer parties to go to, so we started something called Cousins Weekend, where one cousin hosts in whatever city they live in, and we kind of go out and enjoy whatever the fruits of that community. So when we're in Milwaukee, we might go to a hookah bar. In Madison, we go to a hockey game. Oshkosh, we went to a herd game. We always make sure to play games. And, yeah, I think we have a lot of uninterrupted joy, not a lot of cell phones. A lot of fun.
Jesse, thank you so much for sharing that. And that reminds me of a point I wanted to bring up, Marie. I've got a ton of cousins. We're all over the country now. And is that a thing that maybe gets in our way with this in America? A lot of us are mobile. Maybe those cousins aren't in the same place or the friends aren't in the same place. It's hard to keep recreating this hygge environment with each other.
Yeah, it's definitely difficult to create hygge if you are not together in the same space. So you have to recreate that, I suppose, as you said, in every new space that you go to teach your friends how this is a worthwhile way of interacting.
Thanks a lot for that call, Jesse, and for sharing that. Now, we talked earlier, Marie, about how we as individuals can embrace this idea of hygge. What would we have to do to make it more of a cultural norm across the country?
That's a difficult question. I think that we would be happier in general if we put away devices and were more intentionally intimate, but it does require each of us to act in this particular way. Returning to the happiness ratings is that there are lots of things one can do at the cultural level or societal level that can improve happiness, and perhaps some of those we're not able to do individually, such as creating more income inequality or increase trust.
And as we start to wrap up, Marie, I keep seeing, as I look at health research and psychology research, the value of social connection for happiness, which is what we've been talking about, but for physical and mental health, too. Do you want to leave us with the case for however we try to do it, building those social connections?
Absolutely. So connecting with other people is ultimately what contributes to well-being.
You've got a few more moments to dig into that.
All right. So the well-being is coming exactly like you said, from interpersonal connections, but also from living in a society that you think is just and fair, in which you have a chance to get ahead. So it's not all residing in the individual. I think that societies can also do a lot, which is why actually a lot of countries are now attempting to look at policies and how they affect not just the economic bottom line, but also happiness overall in a given population.
Marie, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you for having me.
That's Marie Helwig-Larsen. She's a professor of psychology at Dickinson College in Pennsylvania, and she's from Denmark originally. We talked about her piece in The Conversation, Why Denmark Dominates the World Happiness Report Rankings Year After Year, and she introduced us to the concept of hygge, which I think I'm saying pretty close to right now, this idea of intentionally creating situations where we interact well with other people without distractions, create a sort of intimacy. It could involve a fireplace, but it doesn't have to. Share your stories if you do something like this in your life. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR or email ideas@WPR.org. classic candy loved and hated by many could be on the way out, and that has fans doing some serious panic buying. The makers of Necco Wafers announced last month that they may shut down operations if they can't find someone to buy the company. As the Washington Post reports, fans of Necco Wafers are calling in bulk orders. Jay Carlisle Larson is here. She and I have different opinions. JC, hi.
Yeah, I'm squarely in the not a fan camp of Necco Wafers, if you can call them candy, chalk, I don't know.
Right, for people who haven't encountered them, they come in these rolls, and they're these little disc-shaped candies, and they're, I mean, even as someone who liked them, I went through a Necco phase, they're kind of chalky and dry. Yeah.
I think that chalky, dry works in that description. I'm sure that there are a lot of listeners out there who are shaking their fists at the radio right now, just so mad over my way I think about Necco wafers, but it tastes like eating dust.
My brother and my folks and I went through a Necco phase for a couple years when I was a kid. We always had them around, the multicolor ones and the chocolate. I did
chocolate
in quotes. Because, yeah, if you said, hey, here's some chocolates, and you had a Necco chocolate, I think you'd be disappointed.
My follow-up to that would be why you went through a phase like
this? I don't know. But it does seem, these have been around since the Civil War, and it seems like these are the candies of an era that you didn't want it. You felt bad if you enjoyed something too much.
Sure, but still, maybe it's time for them to say goodbye.
Necco fans, share your angry thoughts. Tweet us at Central Time WPR.